Hello and welcome to Sonnetcast, William Shakespeare's sonnets recited, revealed and relived. I am Sebastian Michael and this is Sonnet 70. That thou art blamed shall not be thy defect, for slander's mark was ever yet the fair. The ornament of beauty is suspect, a crow that flies in heaven's sweetest air. So thou be good, slander doth but approve thy worth the greater, being rude of time. For canker-vice the sweetest buds doth love, and thou present'st a pure, unstained prime. Thou hast passed by the ambush of young days, ere not assailed or victor being charged. Yet this thy praise cannot be so thy praise, to tie up envy evermore enlarged. If some suspect of ill masked not thy show, then thou alone kingdoms of hearts shouldst owe. With Sonnet 70, William Shakespeare once more performs the poetic equivalent of a handbrake turn and swivels what we thought we could understand from Sonnet 69 around 180 degrees to race headlong in the opposite direction. The charge levied against his young lover that with his conduct he has been allowing himself to become common and thus acquire a reputation way beneath his supposedly exalted status is here lifted, and any such insinuation summarily dismissed as slander, prompting us primarily to wonder why. What is causing the accusations against the young man in the first place, and what then brings about this virtuoso ventriloquy trick? And that Sonnet 70 is, in fact, Shakespeare's own response to Sonnet 69 and comes paired with it is in itself, although apparently obvious, not beyond any doubt. Though whether any doubt could be found to be reasonable is something we'll also want to consider carefully, and we will do so, of course, in just a moment, when we will also be listening to both Sonnets 69 and 70 together. But first of all, what does Sonnet 70 actually mean? That thou art blamed shall not be thy defect. That you are blamed shall not be considered to be your fault. The sonnet, as we just noted, seems to connect with and refer directly to the previous sonnet, in which Shakespeare told his young lover that the reason why he is getting a bad reputation is that his behaviour appears to show that he is growing common. This sonnet now, in contrast to Sonnet 69, sets out to make it clear from the very start that actually none of this is the young man's fault. Now, a very minor, but if like me you are genuinely riveted by linguistic detail and love, as I do, the fine points of grammar, and I know this is perhaps a bit of a minority interest, then a fascinating textual issue lies in the little word "are." Most editors simply correct this as they see it, and that's why I put correct here in inverted commas. So, in most renderings of the sonnet, you will read that thou art blamed shall not be thy defect. And at first glance, there seems to be nothing wrong with that. After all, the correct, again, in inverted commas slightly, conjugation for the informal form of address, thou, is indeed art. Thou art. And so it would appear that editors are merely doing our will a favour by putting right something that either he or his typesetter clearly got wrong. Except it is not that simple, nor is it anywhere near as straightforward, because Shakespeare does use the form are with thou on several occasions. Not many, it has to be said, but where he does, he seems to do it when, and therefore possibly because, the word is followed by another consonant. In any case, it would appear that Shakespeare on occasion chooses to use are with thou for euphony in order to get a more pleasing sound. And so for us, this creates a dilemma. should we assume that somebody, either Shakespeare himself or the typesetter working from this manuscript, got this wrong and printed R when really Shakespeare fully intended it to be art? It is entirely possible. It's an easy mistake to make, and the quarto edition is littered with similar, seemingly minor mistakes. But what if Shakespeare didn't make a mistake? What if he wrote down on his page R, and the typesetter here diligently reproduced exactly what he saw? What, indeed, if the typesetter felt minded to correct Shakespeare, and Shakespeare, seeing this, flung his arms in the air in horror and exclaimed, "No, thou shalt not mess with my poetry, peasant." We don't know. And so, as a writer, my instinct is to go with what we have and assume nothing, certainly not that something which may or may not be a mistake is a mistake, simply because it suits our simplistic interpretation of a rulebook which we are in any case no longer all that familiar with, since we have long since ceased conjugating our verbs in this way. And of course, in Sonnet 47, where in fact we very briefly touched on the same issue, although much more briefly than here, Shakespeare says, and this you will usually find honoured in editions of the sonnets, "So either by thy picture or my love, thyself away are present still with me, for thou not farther than my thoughts canst move, and I am still with them, and they with thee." Our sonnet now, Sonnet 70, continues, "For slander's mark was ever yet the fair, because the mark, as in the ugly stain of slander, has always been on those who are beautiful." This is a remarkably compact line where, for our understanding, there is at least an upon missing. We would expect something like, "For slander's mark was ever yet upon the fair." But Shakespeare here takes this as read, simply so the line scans and retains its near-perfect iambic pentameter. It is only near-perfect because the prosody, certainly for our ears today, is slightly hampered by ever, "for slander's mark was ever yet the fair." Whereas in order for it to be a strict iambic pentameter masculine line, it would have to be, "for slander's mark was ever yet the fair." But we'll let him get away with that. Not least because the accent, and therefore the pronunciation, and therefore the emphases, would have been quite different in Shakespeare's day. And we will come back to this, I promise you, in a later episode in the podcast. But it is quite relevant here also because of what follows. Because what follows is, the ornament of beauty is suspect, a crow that flies in heaven's sweetest air. The ornament of beauty is suspicion, and that suspicion is like a black, potentially portentous bird that darkens even the most beautiful sky merely by its presence. The crow, at least since Roman times, has been considered a bird of bad omen, and so if crows start invading your summery, sunny sky, then that is perceived as bad news indeed. Puzzling to us is the use of suspect as a noun. We are tempted to read the sentence as, "The ornament that is beauty is suspect to us," and that would even make some degree of sense, because we could then say, well, a beautiful person who is like an ornament to a setting or a group of people is something suspect, because we can't trust their beauty entirely. And that circumstance then would be the metaphorical crow that flies even in the sweetest air. And perhaps Shakespeare enjoys this secondary reading and invites us to allow it too. But certainly the primary meaning is that beauty is adorned, somewhat perversely or ironically, with suspicion. And suspect here, as indeed defect above, are both stressed on the second syllable, not, as we would do if they were adjectives, on the first. "So thou be good, slander doth but approve thy worth the greater, being wooed of time. And so although you may be good, the slander which settles upon you does in fact only serve to make your high worth and great qualities stand out even more. And these qualities are being wooed of time, meaning that they outlive and overcome time. They are wooed away from the ever-entropic force of time, which ultimately destroys everything and reduces all to nothing, except you, as I, the poet, have told you many times before, and will gladly tell you again in due course. The quarto edition here, incidentally, has their worth, but since there is no plural that this could refer to, it is generally accepted to be a very common there-thy confusion, and therefore gets emended. For canker vice the sweetest buds doth love, and thou present'st a pure, unstained prime. Because, and this now referring again to the sad fact of life that slander attaches itself to everything and everyone that is beautiful, the canker worm, which as a parasitic infestation on flowers damages and ruins them, is drawn to the sweetest, for which again, as so often, read prettiest, most beautiful, most delightful flower buds, and you happen to come along as a pure and unstained prime of life, a youth untainted by sin or scandal. This, as well as the following two lines, directly contradicts what was said in Sonnet 69, where the young man's actions caused him to acquire the rank smell of weeds, and we will look into what the significance of this is in a moment, of course. Thou hast passed by the ambush of young days, ere not assailed or victor being charged. You have passed by, as in missed out on, or deliberately avoided, the usual assault of youthful folly and frolicking, either because you were not ever the target of any such attack on your angelic innocence, or because you conquered it by holding on steadfastly to your unshakable integrity. In light of what we know about the young man, this is plain nonsense. Unless, of course, Shakespeare is either A, talking to somebody else entirely, which in light of Sonnet 69 is improbable, or B, he is being facetious, or C, there is something else going on here, which we shall need to further examine. And for the line to scan and to fit into the uninterrupted pattern of strong or male 10-syllable endings, either the either or the assailed here has to be pronounced with one syllable. So either ere not assailed or victor being charged, or either not sailed or victor being charged. I actually prefer the sound of either not sailed or victor being charged. It sits easier with my received pronunciation, but considering that either is such a common and assailed a rather less common word, and bearing in mind what we know of Shakespeare's dialect, which tends to be quite a touch rounder and more gravelly than how we speak today, my hunch is that in fact the most likely intention is for the line to be read ere not assailed or victor being charged. Along those lines, forgive the dreadful accent, but you see what I'm going for here. Yet this thy praise cannot be so thy praise, to tie up envy evermore enlarged. But this praise of you cannot be left to stand by the world that sees you, because it would, or indeed does, attract and bind to itself the envy of others, which simply grows the more you are praised. And you will find editors also point to the late Middle English meaning of to set free, for enlarge, and it does seem very likely that Shakespeare is at least punning on this, since he gives us the idea of envy being tied up and then forever newly set free. If some suspect of ill masked not thy show, then thou alone kingdoms of hearts shouldst owe. If there were not some suspicion of wrongdoing about you, if people didn't find it necessary to put on you this stain of slander, then you alone would be able to own the kingdom of all hearts, meaning everybody would simply have to love and adore you and nobody else. And note that here, just as in the famous Sonnet 18, O means own. And so here are the two poems, as we believe they are intended, back to back. Those parts of thee that the world's eye doth view want nothing that the thought of hearts can mend. All tongues, the voice of souls, give thee that due, uttering bare truth, e'en so as foes commend. Thy outward thus with outward praise is crowned, but those same tongues that give thee so thine own in other accents do this praise confound by seeing farther than the eye hath shown. They look into the beauty of thy mind, and that, in guess, they measure by thy deeds. Then, Charles, their thoughts, although their eyes were kind, to thy fair flower add the rank smell of weeds. But why thy odour matcheth not thy show? The soil is this, that thou dost common grow. That thou art blamed shall not be thy defect, for slander's mark was ever yet the fair. The ornament of beauty is suspect, a crow that flies in heaven's sweetest air. So thou be good, slander doth but approve thy worth, the greater being rude of time. For canker vice the sweetest buds doth love, and thou present'st a pure, unstained prime. Thou hast passed by the ambush of young days, ere not assailed or victor being charged, yet this thy praise cannot be so thy praise, to tie up envy evermore enlarged. If some suspect of ill masked not thy show, then thou alone kingdoms of hearts shouldst owe. First, then, to the question on which hinge the others. Is this a pair of sonnets that belong together? As flagged up a moment ago, it could be put forward that we have no proof of this. Many, though again by no means all, of the sonnets that follow a previous one as a direct continuation start with a conjunction, a word like but or and or so, making it clear that the argument continues. Sonnet 70 does not do this. It starts with a new sentence that could quite conceivably stand on its own. In fact, the entire sonnet could stand on its own, as could Sonnet 69. And so our, it has to be said, widely accepted contention that these two form a strongly tied pair stems from two simple factors. First, Sonnet 69 talks about wagging tongues spreading a bad metaphorical smell about the young man, which, in all but name, is slander, and Sonnet 70 immediately picks this up and removes the guilt for such slander from the recipient of the sonnet. That this should apply to both this sonnet and the previous one seems obvious. Second, the two sonnets follow each other in the collection. The collection, although it may not be strictly in sequence, is very clearly organized, and sonnets that belong together have deliberately been placed with each other by what Edmondson Wells, you may remember, not only called an ordering mind, but the ordering mind of Shakespeare himself. Whether or not the latter is the case, we can't possibly know, let alone know for certain, but that the former applies is also obvious. On the balance of probabilities, then, and although there is, as so often, no absolute proof, we can be fairly certain that, yes, these two poems form a pair, with Sonnet 70 continuing the argument of Sonnet 69. If that is the case, then the whole construction of this couple of sonnets is astonishing, for exactly the reasons we mentioned and to some extent discussed in the previous episode. Here is what Will is saying to his young man. You are outwardly perfect. This is not news to us. Everybody recognises this and says so. Neither is this, really. We early on got the impression that this young man is generally admired for his looks. But the same people who admire your beauty and say so also now look at what you are up to, and they disapprove of this and disparage your name. And even this does not come as a huge surprise. We know at least part of what the young man has been up to, and we saw Shakespeare's understandably troubled reaction to this on two previous occasions, specifically the crisis from Sonnet 33 intermittently to Sonnet 42, and then again to some extent in Sonnets 57 and 58. And so the fact that the world is beginning to talk also can hardly amaze. So by this point in the proceedings, we are led to believe that what people say about the young man is true, and Shakespeare risks leaving it at that. But then he continues, "Look, it's not your fault that you attract such a bad press. Everybody who is beautiful does. People are envious, and so the better you behave, the more people talk, spreading rumours about you, because if that weren't the case, then you alone would be the king of all love and adoration." Which doesn't strictly follow. It is not actually the logical consequence that the young man would in this way, if there were no slander upon him, be the only person that is lovable in the world. It is a poetic Shakespearean non sequitur. But that is almost by the by, because as we have seen before, logic is not Shakespeare's strongest suit. Now, there are two possible reasons why a poet might write in two such distinct and independently viewable parts. Either because that's what was always his intention, Shakespeare frequently spreads an argument or a theme over two sonnets, sometimes more, so why not here? It's not entirely unlike starting a birthday card on the left-hand page because you know from the outset that you are going to cover two pages, and there is almost no reason to assume that this here isn't the case. Except that there is also the possibility that there was a comeback to Sonnet 69 from the young man, to which this sonnet, Sonnet 70, is in turn the response. On one or two occasions previously have we aired the possibility that these sonnets may form part of an informal exchange, either accompanying or acting as letters. Sonnet 26 very clearly is either conceived as a letter or sent along with one, since it actually states, "To thee I send this written embassage." And there have been one or two other instances when we thought there was a distinct possibility that a sonnet was composed in response to a response from the young man. Sonnet 58 to 57, in fact, sounds a bit like that, although there, as here, it is just as imaginable that Shakespeare composed both poems from the outset, almost conducting something of an internal dialogue with his young lover. So what is the answer? We have no idea. We really are entirely in the realm of conjecture from here on in if we pursue this, but for me, who I constantly see these people in their, to us, so familiar and yet at the same time so alien existence, it is more than a little attractive to imagine the young, impetuous, even at times petulant nobleman reading or hearing Sonnet 69 and storming into Will's study, shoving a piece of parchment or paper in the poet's face and demanding to know what he means by this. In fact, Shakespeare may, for all we know, have voiced in his inimitable fashion signals he's picked up from the grapevine with good intentions. Who's to say that he's not meaning to alert the young man, knowing he has at least some of his ear some of the time? And then, once so confronted, in kicks the retreat to appease his young lover, not to risk losing him? And we really need to phrase this as a question because it's only one of a million different possible scenarios. That Shakespeare does not want to lose his lover hardly needs speculating or explaining, whether for purely emotional, personal reasons or, as we think may quite possibly also be the case, for professional reasons too, you do not want your young, beautiful, rich, influential lover to be angry with you for long. And just to briefly recap, in case you wonder, I don't think we need to doubt greatly that we are dealing with the same young man, Shakespeare's young lover, the fair youth. because Sonnet 70, as we just saw, is almost certainly the direct continuation of Sonnet 69. If it is, then it by necessity has to be addressed to the same person. Sonnet 69, as we also saw, fits the profile of the young man to the extent that we know him perfectly. And so, seeing there is no good reason to assume otherwise, other than the radical change in tone and direction, we probably really don't need to look further. But how radical is this change in tone, really? In Sonnet 69, Shakespeare refers to the people spreading gossip about the young man, or possibly to their thoughts, as churls. Whether it is the people or their thoughts, the implication is the same. He uses a mild term of admonishment that in other instances he has deployed tenderly, even lovingly, to chide the people who are harming the young man's reputation. It's not dissimilar to us using a word like rascals. It hardly implies moral outrage at damned lies being disseminated. It is, in other words, mildly ironic. And then, in Sonnet 70, Shakespeare goes over the top with his characterization of the young man as pure, untainted, unassailed by the dangers and temptations that come with young age. Knowing everything we know about this young man and his conduct in relation to Shakespeare and Shakespeare's mistress so far, and the anxieties and anguish this has caused, that is plainly ridiculous. Shakespeare is either teasing his young man, or he is playing to his vanity, or he is being so supremely disingenuous that we have to wonder, is he pulling someone's leg? And it is really this total incredulity instilled in us by Sonnet 70 that makes me favour the idea that Shakespeare might be responding to a response, that he once again overstepped the mark with his verse and is trying by the same means to make amends. The truth, though, is that you will have to either draw your own conclusions or leave this conundrum, like so many others, unresolved, because Shakespeare himself does not provide anything that could be considered conclusive. With Sonnets 69 and 70, the group of Sonnets 61 to 70 comes to an end, and with Sonnet 71 a new phase begins that does not explore entirely new themes. Mortality, the passing of time, the love for the young man all remain present, but they reach a new depth, and with it a new sincerity, before at the midpoint with Sonnet 77, yet again, everything changes. Remember that you will find all the sonnets we have discussed so far, together with the transcript of the podcast, at sonnetcast.com, where there is also a contact form should you wish to get in touch with me about anything. If you find any mistakes, if you have any questions, any suggestions, any queries, I'll be happy to hear from you. And there is also a donate button. If you are in a position to help me make this podcast, then I truly appreciate your assistance. We are reaching the halfway point of this labour of love in every sense of the word, and I'm truly grateful to those of you who have already lent me your support. In any case, though, and most importantly, I hope you will join me again here on Sonnetcast, where we recite, reveal, and relive the sonnets of William Shakespeare.